Welcome to the M-Files. You are listening to Valerie Anella Mayers, Patty Wood Finkel, and John Woodward bringing you the news, reviews, and interviews from the museum world. On this edition of the M-Files, we will be speaking with our friend and museum colleague, Danny Bills, the curator of collections and exhibitions, Wichita Falls Museum of Art at MSU, Texas.
All right, now we're going to jump into the museum wire, and we've pulled out the magic hat again. And this week, the hat has chosen the topic of favorite fundraisers. We've all worked in different fundraising activities over the years. So, Danny, let's kick it off. What's one of your favorite or more memorable fundraisers you've been involved with?
Well, we have one that we've been doing for the last decade or so, where we can we call it the collector circle. And so people in the community give a certain amount of money and it goes into an account. And then at a set date, we invite all those people to come into the museum. This is pre-COVID. And I put up artwork for the collection. And so I go out and I select things that are, you know, fit their collection. It works on paper collection, and we have those on the wall and out on tables and things like that. And it's more than they can afford with what they've donated. So then we go into a voting system where they all get to vote on which pieces they want. And of course, it's got to go through a few rounds before you can narrow it down to certain ones. And then when they get that piece, then that amount comes out of the pot and they keep going. And you end up with a situation where, you know, one table may try to gang up on another table. There's a lot of that little miniature reality show stuff that starts to go on. And it gets kind of interesting. And one year in particular, probably my favorite year, I really wanted this one piece that had almost all of the money that they had. But it was an artist that was pretty famous and was in bad health. And I thought, we better get this piece of artwork now. And so they agreed to that. And so they were out of money like right away. And they bought a couple more little things. And then all of a sudden the checkbook started coming out and they started buying more pieces, you know, just straight up out of their, you know, so we got our six or seven pieces that we got that year. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, really nice gentleman was standing there with his wife and was talking to me. He says, "Is there a piece you wanted that you didn't get?" And I pointed at the one on the wall behind him, and she was talking to somebody else, so she didn't hear what he was saying. He said, "Okay, go ahead and get it." And she turned around and said, "What happened?" I said, "You just bought a piece of art." You know, so it was really great. And like I said, it's been around for a long time. I don't remember you remember the year the MPMA was in Oklahoma City? Remember what year that was?
16?
Yeah, I think it was like 15 or 16.
I think it was 16. But so we did our collector circle as a panel at that conference. And we were there with Adam Harris from Jackson Hole and Joe Shank from Corpus Christi. And so all three places had different models. Like Jackson Hole, they were getting like, I think it was $5,000 a couple to come to the event.
Well, Jackson, I mean, we need to pause and talk about the people that live in Jackson. It's the wealthiest zip code in the United States. Yeah, Adam Duncan Harris is a very lucky curator. He's a great curator, but he's also fortunate with the funding.
Yes, because, so Joe Shank, he was doing it for about half that amount of money, and ours was rather... is more like $250 a person. So I was a little bit nervous going into it thinking, oh, these are the, you know, big league people. But then I realized as I watched people come in to sit down for the panel, they didn't have anything. They didn't have a program. So they were looking to start one. Mm-hmm. So they were probably going to start at the level that we were, most likely. So that was real interesting to get that back and forth there with those guys. And I ended up talking to Joe at that conference at a lunch or something like that. Maybe it was a dinner. And he started telling me about Cheech Marin's collection.
Oh, yeah.
He has that works on paper collection. Mm-hmm. And I started hunting that down. Plus, I knew an artist that was in the collection who's in the Arlington, Texas area. long story short, we ended up getting, we were the last place to get that Works on Paper before he took it off the road and is now going to create that museum in Riverside and donate it to it. But but that was a lot of MPMA had a factor in that too. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really interesting. And so it was a nice little story. And it was funny because, you know, you get that kind of feedback from, you can hear the mistakes even the bigger people have made, like, yeah, we bought this sculpture for such and such money, but we didn't have any money set back for the base. And now it's in the lobby, you know? And so, like, I was always scraping off some money for framing at the very beginning, you know, mm-hmm. Works on Paper collection, because, mm-hmm. you know, and that kind of thing. So that's a program that's been growing. And now we're at a point where we're trying to figure out a way to get different levels of people involved, because I think the Jackson Hole model, as expensive as it was, it had a sub group of young professionals or something mm-hmm. like that that were given $100 a piece and buying less expensive works of art. Mm-hmm. So there's ways to work that at different levels. But being a curator of collections and exhibitions, that's the type of fundraiser that appeals to me. If I was a director, I'd probably be talking about something like the annual appeal or something that would, you know, keep the doors open a little bit better, but I get excited about that one.
The NIC does something similar.
Yeah, there's the Nicolaysen Art Museum here in Casper, something similar where you have one night with tickets that, you know, are a little more expensive. And that also includes an art auction, and the pieces do have a higher starting point. And then the other night is a less expensive entry ticket. It's not a full sit-down dinner. It's more hors d'oeuvres and music, but the price point for the art that's being auctioned is also lower. So they have what they call the bash and the ball. So you have the, you know.
Are the people buying the artwork for themselves, or is it for the museum?
There's a combination of both, but the pieces that would go for the museum, those are part of the ball. Because obviously those are going to be at the higher price point, and those who are attending are probably going to be two major sponsors of the event mm-hmm. that could also contribute in this manner.
And we'll see what that does too, is that helps to grow that idea of why collecting is important. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you run into people that don't quite get that. I remember, because we're part of the university, which we didn't start out that way, but we are now, we have sort of a different kind of governing board. We have the same board that governs the whole university. And so mm-hmm. I would send these accession things for them to vote on. And I got a call one day from somebody in the office wanting to know how big the vault was. And I said, I can measure it. Why are you asking this question? They said, well, one of the board of regents made the comment, aren't they full yet? So Not getting the concept that it's works of paper, and a lot of paper fits in flat files. So, you know, we got tons of room. But anyway, that's a mentality I'm not prepared for, because I'm getting, as you know, what I can get in there for people down the road that are going to see this when I'm gone.
One of the most fun or most interesting fundraisers I've been involved with was when I was working up at the Sheridan County Museum, now the Museum at the Bighorns. The museum facility is overlooking a street, goes down into the start of the historic district, and every spring, one of the local dude ranches, Eaton's Ranch, will drive their horses down Fifth Street and through town. And for years, people would sit at the Sheridan Inn, which is at the corner of Broadway and Fifth, to watch the horses go by. But, you know, the museum was right up the street, and so we had a perfect view and a great hillside. We started doing a pancake breakfast the last year I was there. The year before, we had sold donuts and coffee and kept running out of both. But, you know, the big takeaway was we were able to do something relatively inexpensive.
Right.
Had a built-in crowd, a built-in appeal. You know, people always talk about the big fundraiser versus the small fundraiser. Should we go for the big event that has a very high cost point
mm-hmm.
that
they do.
Can be a little bit more risky versus, you know, going out and doing a pancake feed that's going to cost a fraction of that? Yeah, you're not going to raise as much, but that percentage, you know, instead of maybe a 10 or 15% gain on your investment, you're getting 30 or 40. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot different. I mean, you know, coming from a director standpoint, you know, those annual appeals are typically one of the best fundraisers I've seen, because the amount of time you put into them,
right,
and what you get out is so
the
much.
The overhead is. Yeah.
Especially if you have a letter folding machine. I personally think those machines are the best and the coolest thing since sliced bread. Being able to run...
I don't know that I've ever even seen one.
Oh, let me tell you, they are fantastic. Being able to run 500 letters through one of these things,
yeah,
that would take, you know, a room of volunteers 4 or 5 hours in about 5 minutes, and then having it designed so you just have to put them in an envelope and zip them off.
All right.
Yeah, I will advocate for a letter folding machine.
And see, what John's talking about there is a core thing too that I think to fundraising, which is you got to factor in the impact on the staff. You know, sometimes these big ideas, these big fundraisers, they devastate a staff, and nobody on the outside sees that. So they see this great thing, but you know, mm-hmm, like when you start talking about low overhead and things like that, then you get a bigger net gain.
One of the best fundraising training sessions I ever went to was actually not at a museum conference, but it was at the Wyoming Nonprofit Association's mm-hmm convention in Cheyenne, probably about 6 years ago. They had the development director from the Buffalo Bill Center of the West at the time come in and talk about those big events. And one of the things she really hit on was, just like you said, Danny, the impact of the staff and volunteers, how much manpower is being put into those events, and how to factor that cost in. So say you have a gala mm-hmm fundraiser and you raise, you know, above your cost, say $20,000 or $30,000, but then you factor in what would you have paid a staff person, or what did you pay in those indirect costs to make that happen? And then you start seeing that chunk begin to be eroded away.
Can you come and explain that to my staff? We've been going back and forth and back and forth about conference and such planning costs.
Big events are great if they work, and if you can get above a certain price point, and you can get things like sponsorships, and you can get some of the games that happen, or if you can get volunteers that are willing to donate time. You know, if you can get that, that offsets the time and expense you have to devote from your staff. Unless you're comfortable doing that and you've done that year in and year out, it can be extremely intimidating to try and start that off, because you're facing this event that looks, you know, so big that, and it can burn people out if they're not prepared.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
And sometimes there is a signature event, though. I mean, that's just all-consuming. Mm-hmm. But then your institution becomes known for it. And that's when it's worthwhile, when it's getting a lot of traction and it's like the must attend event for, mm-hmm, you know, that time of year. There's always the event in November that everybody has to go to because that's the most fun party.
Yeah, you know, galas are, you know, the one thing that comes to mind when you mention something like that. The problem you run into with some of those is what happens when you try and make it too big. You know, there is a threshold when it becomes, you know, as it's growing and it's becoming popular, that it's, you know, there's always a drive to make it more innovative the next year to help keep mm-hmm that vibe. Mm-hmm. But there is a tilt point mm-hmm where you can go off on the other side mm-hmm and you end up throwing your costs off. You end up losing your audience and your market share. Mm-hmm. I mean, that can happen if you don't innovate. So it's fundraising is a strange monster. Mm-hmm.
I noticed a lot of them tend to be like TV shows. After 7 seasons, they just tank.
I think
jump the shark.
Yep, that's exactly what I was thinking. I think that sort of rounds up our nice discussion on fundraising in the Museum Wire. So let's go ahead and jump into the interview segment.
Excellent. All right, our guest today is Danny Bills. As I said earlier, the curator of collections and exhibitions at the Wichita Falls Museum of Art at MSU Texas, which is in Wichita Falls, Texas. He is a native of Wichita Falls, and he has a Bachelor of Fine Arts and Master of Fine Arts in printmaking. He has been an adjunct art instructor for over 15 years at Midwestern State University, North Central Texas College, and Cameron University in Oklahoma. He has been a member of MPMA, the Mountain Plains Museum Association, since 2014, and has been a state representative on the board the last few years. Now on to our interview with Danny.
Welcome, Danny.
Hello.
How are you tonight?
Good.
Good. I wanted to thank you for talking to us today, and I wanted to ask you our first question. It's the same question that I ask all of our guests. What is the strangest thing that has ever happened to you at a museum? Now, this could be your current museum, a museum that you used to work at, a museum you were visiting, any museum.
Well, so on my very first day, back in 1998, I came in at 9, and around noon, they showed me to the front desk and said, okay, here's how the phones work. The rest of us are going to lunch. Which was only four. There's only four people total, so three people left. So that I thought was a little strange. And then one time after, this has probably been sometime between 2005 and 2009, I came around through the lobby and was going down the main hallway towards the administrative parts, and a ferret was running down the hallway towards me.
Wait, like a pet ferret or a wild ferret? Or
I'm assuming it was a pet. It kind of hugged the wall. It didn't really get aggressive or anything. I probably could have picked it up, but I sort of shuttled it off into a room, and we ended up calling someone. But yeah, I think somebody didn't treat their Christmas present with enough responsibility, and it got out. And then another strange thing was, I didn't discover this myself, but somebody had to do something in a ceiling, and right there over an air vent was a desiccated coiled up snake. So it was just coiled up perfectly, like it had almost been a taxidermy thing. And so I think it's kind of funny. I mean, can you imagine popping the ceiling tile up and seeing that right there?
No.
But I'm sure there's a lot more of those things that I've forgotten, you know.
Or blocked.
They come up later in the end.
Apparently, we used to get rabbits in the museum all the time back before we had AC, and we'd prop the doors open. I'm so glad we have AC now.
We get the occasional feral cat. We had somebody who changes out the filters on the roof, not put the panel back on, because we were really trying to figure out how this cat got in. And so later, you know, several weeks later, somebody was up on the roof and noticed it. But we had these really nice, I think they're called island lights or something like that, in a room, and it used the top of them a little bit.
Aww.
You know, and so yeah, because it had come down from that direction. And anyway, that's a nightmare, because they move around all night, so the alarms keep going off and you keep getting phone calls. And then when you come in there, you don't see them. You know, I got a call one time, because birds hit the windows and stuff on Sunday, and I went in there, and I couldn't find anything, and I thought maybe the bird hit the window, and I walked into this one room, and I think it was a pigeon. It had hit it so hard and so flush that all the little dust or whatever that's on its body flew off and transferred to the window, like a perfect drawing of this bird, you know. And then had hawks hit the window. The trees reflect in the window, and they just got to go for it. You know, so.
Poor pigeon.
Oh, so
we had a fundraiser for the food bank, an empty bowls thing. And as we were packing up and everybody was leaving out, that's when this giant hawk hit the front door window and then lay there for like a minute or so. So nobody wanted to go in or out, because they didn't want to get all of a sudden it comes to and it goes after you, you know. And it kind of came to, and then when it took off, it hit every single window down the side of the building. Aww. Trying to turn around. So, but we're kind of an unintentional bird sanctuary. We got a little lake beside us and tons of geese and ducks and things like that. So something's always happening.
So would you please share more about the museum? May we learn more about the history, location, and an overview of the institution?
Sure. So it's in Wichita Falls, Texas. It officially opened in 1967. That was a big push by the community, in particular the Junior League, or Junior Service League, I think they were called. I had to make some notes on this. And it opened as the Wichita Falls Museum and Art Center. So it had that kind of designation. And so they opened with a lot of, they wanted to do art and science and history and things like that. And so they opened in 67. And in 79, we had the tornado, one of the more famous tornadoes for Wichita Falls, come through there and really ripped the town apart. And it dug into the museum some too. So there had to be some renovation done on that. That's when we picked up a collections area that was really nice. Got a vault out of that deal and things like that. We also have a collection of photographs by a photographer named Frank Golke, who was originally from Wichita Falls. He was in Colorado when the storm hit, but he came home the next day, or came back to Wichita Falls the next day and took pictures around town. Then he came back a year later and took a picture from the same exact spot. So they're all presented as diptychs. You get an after and then a year after. And you have to be real careful when you talk to people, because you don't want to insult a patron, but they like to walk up and go, "Is that before and after?" And I always think to myself, man, how mad would you be if somebody was out in front of your house the day before a tornado taking a picture? And you said, "What are you doing?" "Oh, nothing. See you in a year." You know, like they somehow knew that it was going to hit. But no, we have that legacy. So that's something we've put up every April. April 10 is the anniversary of that. So the community comes around for that. So and then we were accredited in 73.
Wow.
And somehow, sometime during the 80s, I think that didn't get renewed. So so we re-accredited in 19 with AAN. And of course, in 2005, we merged with our college, local college, it happens to be across the street, and Midwestern State University. And so shortly after merging in 2005, we changed it to Wichita Falls Museum of Art, and decided to focus on the art aspect of it. And that was pretty strong. There had been one of the things that made the collection so strong, and I'll talk about this, is the because the museum came about in 1967, the art world was really going strong with pop art at the time. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was working really well was printmaking, because the painters or whoever they were, they could make prints or have prints made, and they would sell cheaper than the paintings, and they would get out to more people. So we were able to collect big name artists back then. And in 1974, and they don't do this now, but the National Endowment for the Arts had grants to help you buy artwork. And wow, they would be a $1 for $1 matching grant. So if you raised a dollar, they gave you a dollar. So however much you could raise, they'd give you that much. So we hit some big names back in like 74. It's a really great, great thing. So we've built on that. And so today, and we've had more renovations. In 2010, we renovated our galleries. In 2015, we had an outdoor pavilion built for concerts and things like that, and a terrace also for events and activities. And so we pretty much, follow the, we're trying to be an educational museum now. We follow the that mission. We're really connected to the university and providing that to the community.
That's fantastic.
That's 53 years in a very small nutshell.
Well, Danny, I can see your aesthetic eye just by looking at the background during this interview of your home. I am totally engaged by the art that is hanging on the wall behind you. You're just so perfectly placed. It must just be aesthetic serendipity that you, being an artist, kind of framed the background for this interview. It's awesome.
And I angle it that way too, so you don't see the kitchen, but yeah.
Well,
and you see all the crazy stuff, but yeah, the ceramic plates that I collected when I was in graduate school from other people, and then the prints I've collected over the years.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
In the background there.
Well, you know, Danny, one of the, you're in a unique position that, you know, you've been in the museum field for 20 years, and unlike some of the other professionals we work with that, you know, we'll move from institution to institution. You've spent all of your time at the Wichita Falls Museum of Art. So, you know, as you know, throughout that time, you know, talk to us about your you know, what your average day is like, and maybe how that's changed during your tenure at the museum.
Sure. So the titles change quite often. I don't change, but the titles change. So as the job description changes, there's a flow to that. But mostly what I did at the beginning was I did a lot of registrar things with cataloging the collection and things, and the curation of shows out of the collection. We had at the time when I started, we had a curator of education and exhibits. So the exhibits part was on somebody else to bring those in. So, but when they said, we want you to do a collections exhibit, that would be mine. So day to day, right now, I do a lot of things that I do more research and writing than I was able to do in the past. And I enjoy that. And I do the gallery tours. But I still have some other stuff like, you know, running to Office Depot and buying things because I'm one of the two people that has the right credit card to do that with. Or,
I went to my
cutting
house today.
Mats because I, in a background I ran a, before I got into museum work I ran a frame shop, you know, a custom frame shop. So I have people in my in the place that could cut mats. The problem is it's ragboard and it's real heavy and tough, and they just sort of back out of it. I do that, but the do a lot of correspondence. There's big emphasis on collaboration right now. And so I'm always talking to somebody about an exhibit or something to do with the university and try to bring that in. Last couple of exhibits we've had little things, little contributions from the faculty at MSU. So like this next exhibit that's coming up at the end of this month is on dwelling. It's called Dwelling Experiences of Shelter, and it's dealing with feelings during the pandemic. Because I noticed that we had a lot of pieces of art in our collection that would be people in their homes or somebody staring out a window or just a house with the yard and the trees or whatever. And it looks different to me now. It looks like where before I thought somebody might just be enjoying being at home by themselves and having a peaceful moment, now can look kind of trapped or something like that. So we've got a lot of kind of a re-examination of that. That kind of thing going on, and then we have contributions from people to write in and talk about it, and then we try to do a as much of an interactive as you can do right now, which is like a story wall, so you could share your story by writing it on a piece of paper and pinning it to the wall, and then you disinfect everything after you do that. And so that's I don't know how my day to day seems to not be day to day. You know, there's always the things you want to get done, and then I call it surprise work. The surprise work pops up, and something else happens. But I've sort of moved. I don't know if I've moved up the ladder so much, but we do have a collections manager now, which is great because I think there's going to ask me a question later on about preservation, and I'll wait till then to bring her up, but. It's helped me a lot to have somebody who can do condition reports and things like that, so I can free up on choosing exhibits and you know, so much research just goes down the drain until you find that one thing you want and spend a lot of time on that.
I really like that idea for the exhibition. All these ideas about quarantine must be just permeating, you know, our minds, because the most recent exhibition that I planned and installed are all these wide open spaces. It's the vast landscapes of the West. So you see cowboys out, you know, with cattle, vast forest scapes. And so it's almost too a look at, you know, what we've been thinking about and our daily ideas about space being constricted and opening up again. I think that there's a lot to mine from this experience.
AAMG opened their registration today, and a lot of that is talking about, a lot of their sessions are going to be talking about using campus and university museums as places for reflection on the pandemic and how the campus and university museums can help facilitate those discussions with the with the campus, with the students and with the faculty and staff and with the community. So they're really focusing on that this year. So it's interesting that is kind of coming full circle with everyone. Mm-hmm.
So you have been you've been talking about some of your job duties and how your day is engaged. What are some of your most surprising job duties? Favorite, least favorite?
Yeah, so early on, I was, like I said, 28 years old, 1998, whatever, sent outside to pick flowers that were just growing in the little planter there beside the museum to put into some kind of little jar for a boardroom table. And, you know, because I was, you know, I got called away from the vault to go do that. So then some point we bought geraniums for like $3 from a nursery to sell them for $5 to the members and then drive around in a van and drop them off. So I was doing that. And then we did a mural project. This is more recently, where people in the community, there were these panels that were about like 24 by 30. And I forget how many there were, but I had to drill 6 holes in each one. And that somehow that fell to me. So I drilled all the panels, and then somebody, they told me the size to drill them at what turned out to be the shaft of the screw, not the threads of the screw. So they wouldn't pass. So I had to re-drill them all over again.
Oh,
this is that Hardy backer board, like you use in your kitchen, that stuff that's almost like stone. So, yeah, so the way I saw it, that, you know, those are three surprise duties. And then my least favorite duties are those same three, those same three all over again. Picking flowers and delivering flowers and drilling a bunch of holes twice.
Yeah, I think we all have those surprise duties. Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorites, and it's also both surprising and one of my least favorites, was having to change the light bulbs in the fixtures in the parking lot of my last museum. Having to get the man lift out there and put it all the way up to the top and be swaying in the wind with a safety harness in the wind. Oh, yeah.
Because it's always windy in Wyoming.
It was a time for introspection and prayer as I was up there by myself. So, but we all have those. So, Danny, you've talked a little bit about, you know, the collections in your museum in terms of the artwork a little bit, but can you elaborate about, you know, in terms of the scope, you know, range, media, and more importantly, what is your favorite piece in your collection?
Okay. So our collection is pretty focused on the works on paper and that includes drawings and prints and things like that. We do have some paintings. Those are usually were donated at some point. We got to, it was in 2018, I believe, the Contemporary Austin Museum changed its mission, its art collecting mission, to large sculptures from everything else, and gave 900 paintings and prints and drawings to the Blanton, which is the UT Austin, mm-hmm. University of Texas Austin Museum, which they decided, and I never found out why they decided what they did, but they decided to keep about half of that and then redistribute the other half. And I got to represent the museum along with 16 or 17 other Texas museums, go down there and do this weird kind of lottery, bargaining, haggling, backstabbing kind of thing to get pieces of this artwork from that collection. So that was an opportunity, because sort of with the mission and a plan with Collector Circle, we're probably going to stick with works on paper. But we do have this large, interesting photography collection that we've developed, three or four photography collections that we've developed over the years. So we're known for that. We have 770 something glass plate negatives from 1922 and earlier. And we've offered a couple of different grants. We've printed off about, we've contact printed all of them. So all 5x7 plates are printed in that form. And then we have enlarged for exhibition purposes about 60 of them over two different grants. So that really helps. It fits the mission and it helps the community that sometimes they want to come in for some history too. And we're not a historical object place, but we can fill that need with those photographs. But my favorite piece for a long time was an etching by Jim Dine. It's called Redbeard, but it's a giant paintbrush. And the thing about his work, he would take the metal plate and throw it in the back of the pickup truck and drive around with it for a little while, so it was all scratched up. Then he would do these really impressive, masterful, delicate etching drawings on, you know, draw into the ground and etch it. So it's this real delicate, perfect image with these marks and scratches. And then he would addition that, then he would change the plate and addition it again and change it and change it, keep going and keep going. So it says paintbrush on it, but it's called Redbeard. And you can tell that the brush is hanging like this. And so all the bristles have gotten longer and longer through the different additions. And he printed it in red ink. So I guess that's why he called it Redbeard. But I don't totally gravitate towards that piece because we're getting so many good things in with the collector circle that I'll spend time with something new and kind of enjoy that piece. We do have some unusual stuff in the collection that we have a bison skeleton that I found out through a story of why we have it and how we got it. And it was when the museum opened, that was going to be the science part. That skeleton was going to be the science part of the opening first when they first opened. And they basically, a rancher agreed to let them whack his bison. He had a bunch of them and that one was pretty old. So they whacked it and they took it to the university, and the university put the bugs on it and removed all the stuff. Then they wired it up for the lobby and it's just, you know, sitting on the shelf, top of this shelf in the vault forever. And we were doing an oral history thing, talking to some older members of the community. And this person I was talking to described the day that they did that as it was basically like a barbecue hot dog hamburger thing with a lot of people and kids out there. And at some designated point, they separated him from the herd, took him to the middle of an arena, gave him the last meal that looked like a birthday cake, and then popped him. And so I left that interview and I went back to the museum and I immediately climbed the ladder and looked at the skull and I didn't see a hole, but as I felt around on it, I felt a depression that had been spackled in. So yeah, he was the one. right in the forehead. So so we have some things that we're in the process of looking at, you know, what to do with. We have oil field equipment, you know, giant mm-hmm. wrenches and stuffed birds, barbed wire, all kinds of, you know, saddles and some other stuff like that too. I don't do much with that because it doesn't fit mission. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it gets a little unusual because you'll find out, like, you'll see something that came from the university back when the museum first opened. And so if your idea is to give it to the university, that's not going to work. So, but yeah, it's I like the, there's a lot of, even within the artwork, we've been able to, especially during COVID, we've had to do a lot of collections exhibits. So we've been able to, there's enough diversity in those 1600 pieces. And I think our oldest piece is, I have it written down, a 1677 print. Wow. And I know we have the 1700 Paul Revere Boston Massacre piece.
Really?
Yeah. So, and we've had some, the history department of MSU do a seminar with some local, you know, K-12 kids. And that piece was a big center part of that.
Oh my goodness. I show it when I'm talking about Copley's portrait of Paul Revere, just to, you know, and Revere as an artist. Yeah.
Well, that's what happened was he was a silversmith, and the engraving he did on silver translated to engraving on a plate, which translated to printing. So that's how that, and he was even making some images and selling them at the time too. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting pieces in there, and I've got some wish list items too that I want to get a hold of. So it's growing, and I'm sure that if I get a really big wish list item, that'll be my favorite piece for a year or two, and the next one, and so forth. So, but I really think you gotta build that legacy for what's happening, and let it go to the next generation.
So you talked, you touched on a little bit earlier, preservation. Could you tell us a little bit about all of the care that goes into such a varied collection?
Sure. Yeah. So especially, you know, works on paper, because one of the things, we're part of a regional museum network, and we're like the art museum. And then there's, most of them are history museums or natural science museums. And so when we use the word exhibit, it doesn't mean the same thing. Like I'll do, when I do an exhibit, it's a 3 month or 4 month visual engagement where they're thinking more permanent, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll build something, it'll stay semi-permanent for a long time. So, but what we have to explain to people that don't quite understand that is that the paper being exposed to the light will die. And it'll rot. So if you leaving it up for 12 months or displaying it for 3 months over 4 years, you extend that life. So you can get it out there decades and decades and still have people see it. I remember going to, I believe it was at the Amon Carter in Fort Worth, and I was walking through, and they had this photograph from the Civil War, and they had it under a black piece of cloth. So you could lift the cloth and look at it and put it back down. Because they just didn't want it exposed to any light that was just when no one was looking at it, you know. And so that's the biggest thing we watch out for is light. Humidity, temperature controls. Like I said, we've got a nice vault that's like 50% humidity, 68 degrees in there, which is perfect. I'd walk in there on a summer day just to walk in there. But
I was about to say, in Texas, that's a really nice... Nice temperature and humidity to maintain.
Yeah, it keeps the air conditioner guys on call.
So.
Yeah, because it's had its own little alarms to tell you if the humidity's off or something else is off. And so we watch everything. We've got the little ink pens that you can put on. You can draw them across a piece of mat board or something. If it turns a certain color, it'll tell you if it's, you know, acidic or not. Mm-hmm. We've got... all the different things that we interleave things with. Lots of flat file drawers. I was just explaining this to somebody who was interested in getting some flat files, and they're asking me for a source on it. And I said, well, I don't really have one, because the last three sets I got super cheap because the office supply store wanted to get rid of them. They couldn't sell them. And the only reason they called me was they saw myself and the collections manager in a newspaper article that was about the museum, and the reporter just wanted a shot of us taking something out of a drawer. You know how they set you up like that, they want you to hang something on a wall or something like that. And so I got this call, and I inadvertently gouged the guy because I just didn't have that much money, and he really wanted to get rid of them. And so got them really cheap, but I guess that was a win-win. But the whole building, the whole exhibits area, We're looking into more HVAC situations right now. We have a noise problem in addition to all the other problems you have. And it's a six-figure thing if we want to fix that. So we're constantly doing that. We have little light meters that we go around, and we know how many foot candles you can put on a piece of paper versus a painting versus a piece of ceramics versus a piece of sculpture. And so we're constantly, you know, I remember an MPMA panel in Oklahoma City on light that was very, very informative about the damage it does. And it's just absolute damage no matter what anybody tells you. Jansen, I think, did that panel.
Yeah.
So,
It's molecular when it does do damage. I mean, it's on the molecular level. You can't bring it back.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't. And so, yeah, that's the, myself and our collections manager, that's pretty much our thing is to, you know, of course I drive her crazy because I want to collect more work and she has to store it and we do, it really doesn't matter how long you run an exhibit because people kind of show up at the beginning and then they all come running in at the end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you advertise it ending on a certain day, you're going to get a lot of people in that weekend.
And then you had translate this all in era of COVID from exhibits to virtual too.
Right. Oh yeah. We did that. Actually, we ended up sheltering at home at the end of March, right before we had this big plan to change the look of the tornado exhibit. We were going to have an interactive display. We were going to have a giant map of the path of the storm. We were going to do all these panels and discussions with people. And it just ended up being the pictures online. And we did a good job with it, but it became an online exhibit. And so the effect of that is kind of interesting, though, because all of the writing that I did to make those things go online hasn't changed. We're still doing that much writing. So we just stepped it up another notch. Like it's still got all this social media and website presence that it would have if we were shut down. Plus it's open.
And some other online programming as well recently, correct? Guest writers.
Yeah. Guest writers, we were having these very successful weekend art making workshops where people would come in, we'd get some grant money to buy the supplies, and they would just make artwork and take it home with them. You know, no large scale things, but we couldn't do the contact anymore, so we began to film those things and put them on YouTube.
That's fantastic.
So, and so, you know, and then. If we're going to go ahead and transition that way, we did have some interesting things that weren't online, but were still within the restrictions. We had a fairly new theater professor want to do a play. She had done a play in town where people listened through their cars, their car radios. I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a way to do that. So they're all socially distanced, wearing masks, doing their play, and then you pull up in your car and you tune to a certain station and you can hear what they're saying. And so she did this play on our pavilion where they put markers down where everybody could sit and made everybody wear a mask. So they were all spaced out and they did this play. And then later on, when the ballet, the Wichita Falls Ballet, couldn't do their Nutcracker at Christmas time, we had the dancers come inside the museum, dance in the rooms with all the windows where the birds hit, and they would dance in the windows while the people sat in the courtyard and watched them dance. So it was kind of like watching something online, but watching it in person at the same time.
That's an awesome idea.
Yeah, that sounds beautiful. Yeah,
we made, you know, and that's the collaboration. I mean, rarely, it feels like I don't even do much of an exhibit or a program anymore without having somebody else in it, whether it's one of the history museums or it could even, like, if we're doing something to do with wildlife or something, we get the Riverbend Nature Center or Wildlife Bird Rescue, or somebody makes a comment or does something or contributes some content, and we just keep doing that cross promotion all the time with these other organizations to try to hopefully get those views and that interest in, you know.
So, you know, building on that, where can our listeners check out your institution online? What are your social media contacts?
We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and those can all be found on our website. which I don't have memorized. I could Google it real fast, but so you can get to all those places from the website.
All right. And for our listeners, that will be in the show notes, so you can check out some of that virtual programming and hopefully follow what Danny's doing and his coworkers at the museum.
So, in talking with you, you've mentioned MPMA a couple of times. Mm-hmm. How involved are you with MPMA, and could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I've been on a programming committee for a while, and the first committee I got on was a membership committee, and it was my first or second MPMA, and I reached in the where the tickets are. You know, you get all those tickets to everything,
mm-hmm.
and it said membership breakfast. And I went to it, and I said, I'm not on this committee. And they said, you are now. So I guess, I don't know if they just threw random tickets into people's envelopes or what they did, but it worked.
That's so sneaky, but we should do that.
Now yeah. I remember the scholarship committee. I'm going to try that this year.
Yeah, that's how I ended up as the chairman of the tech committee.
That was the first committee I was on. And then I was on the programming committee. I think I'm still on that committee. I know I am because I got a lot of emails, and and I've been a state rep for the last few years, which is real interesting. And I don't know. I think you know, you can. There's lots of different ways to meet people at those conferences, but committee work, board work, you know. You can always meet them in the bar at night, but there's other, you know, you meet that way. And, you know, it's weird because hardly a week goes by where I don't think, have some kind of thought that somehow connects me back to that kind of, that organizational benefit,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's like, we have a quilt exhibit up right now that we had planned it for a while. We didn't realize that March was quilting month. So that worked out really well. So we're dovetailing this into, it's working really well with women's history. It's working really well with a lot of things. Well, I had all these questions about quilt patterns, and I ended up emailing Jenny.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if it was going to be Jenny or Katie or Heather.
I emailed Jenny. She's the one that makes the quilts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're gorgeous.
I went that way. And so she told me some things, you know, and I mean, I only know that from going to those dinners and watching people go crazy bidding over those things.
Yeah, talk about a fundraiser.
Yeah.
We do put the fun in fundraiser, raising money for scholarships at MPMA.
Or buying
for
turkeys.
The kids.
Yeah. Crazy. It's for the crazy items that people bring to be auctioned. I just think it's hysterical. I feel like I am laughing so hard all night long.
And that stupid turkey sat in my office for a year.
John bought.
Yeah.
And yep. What was it? It came with
some sea rations.
Yeah, sea rations and a plastic turkey.
Yeah.
I want a table centerpiece in Wichita, Kansas that came with a box with a giant bison pie, whatever you call that.
What? Cow patty. Cow patty. Okay.
Yeah.
Cow patty.
I made them re-auction it. I wasn't taking it home. I drove, but it wasn't my car, so, you know. I made them. I think they got $60 for it. I think Bob from the Ulrich Museum there bought that thing. For the kids.
So, Danny, you know, obviously you're an artist as well. I know it sounds like you've been writing more than anything else recently. That's really become a new medium, I would say, for you. But when you do create, what area of printmaking do you explore? You notice something about cyanotypes?
Yeah, so what I tend to do is if there is a visiting artist that does a workshop or something like that, I'll just sort of dip into that, whatever they're doing. So for a long time, I did encaustic painting. after, because I was teaching and there was a workshop for that. And so in the early 2000s, I started doing encaustic painting. And then I translated that into, there's a way to transfer photographs. Like you can warm up the wax and lay a computer printout face down on it, burnish it, and it'll pull mm-hmm. the toner off mm-hmm. of the paper.
Yes.
So I was doing photography in that way. And so what I did was, the first time I went to Japan, I exhibited those. And then when the Japanese people that we collaborated with over in Tokyo came to do their exhibit at my museum, I did a couple more, which is kind of uncomfortable putting that in an exhibit when you work there, but I hit them in the corner. But I did a couple more that were photographs I'd taken in Japan. And so the last trip to Japan, I did the cyanotypes, which are the blue and white photographs that mm-hmm. you see, because we'd had there's a group of people called Shootapalooza. It's a weird kind of name nowadays, but it has to do with photographs, and they travel around and they've done these like cyanotypes that are so large that the fire department has to hose them off to process them. You can go to their website and see these crazy things. And so they're a big collaborative, large group of artists that came in, and they did this week-long workshop, and they had all these materials and pre-sensitized fabrics for people to do anybody that walked in could do these cyanotypes. And so they got me started. So I did some that were exposed on both sides of the photo, and then killed myself building these frames that were, you know, plexiglass on both sides so you could mm-hmm. see through them, and they weighed a lot, so they killed the luggage situation going to Japan. But anyway, those shows were about bringing the art with you anyway. So that's what I tend to do what started that for me was when I was in grad school, we were talking to a visiting artist, and we asked him about how often he sold work. And he said, currently I'm currently I'm the largest owner of my own, I'm the largest private collector of my own work. What that means is you keep making this work, it keeps stacking up and stacking up and stacking mm-hmm. up. So I tend to it's not that I don't want to make it, it's just, do I want to store it? You know, we had a really nice collage artist come in. I got this guy named Paul Valadez, who teaches down in the Rio Grande Valley area of Texas. I got to know him online, and he donated 200 collages to us. And
wow.
They were mounted on something about the size that would be 11 by 17, and they just stacked in one priority mail box. So 200 pieces of art in the mail, you know. And so a year or two went by, and I finally figured out a way. You know, we ended up having him do an exhibit at the museum, and we did the collage workshops and everything like that. So for, you know, 6 months, I was doing collages, you know, because that was the mm-hmm. just getting into it like that. And now recently I've took a continuing ed blacksmithing course. And so which is partially the reason I turned on my air conditioner yesterday, because I came in late at night and it's like, I'm too hot. This is killing me. But I've made a hook that you drive in to hang a plant on, a chisel, two drifts, and a bottle opener.
Well done.
I'm not ready for Forged in Fire, but I made something. So.
Yeah, it's not as easy as they make it look.
Yeah, but in my typical fashion, I've already bought an anvil.
No, Danny, that's great. That's one of those things that I've always wanted to learn myself, and in large part because
don't wait till you're 51. Do it now.
That, yeah, fair point. I'll need a workshop before I do that. I don't think I can do blacksmithing in my wee little apartment.
No, luckily though, we have Fort Caspar Museum here in town. And I know that they've got a couple of guys that volunteer that do mm-hmm. blacksmithing that could probably set you up if you were interested.
Yeah. I just have to steal my great-grandfather's anvil back from my cousin. If he's listening to this, I'm putting him on notice. I'm taking it back.
Hi, cousin.
So, but
anvil prices have gotten crazy.
Mm-hmm.
If you start looking into it's like that show blew it up or something. I don't know what happened, but everybody that has an anvil to sell thinks they have like a pot of gold.
Mm-hmm. It's not just that though. Any kind of crafting, art making, handicraft, things that everybody's always said, oh, well, one day I want to learn to do that. During the pandemic, a lot of people have taken those things up.
Yes.
And then they have, you know, knocked out entire craft sections,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
handicraft sections. I know for a while there, it was hard to get yarn,
mm-hmm.
because everybody started knitting and crocheting and.
Well, not just handicrafts. I mean,
art.
I was thinking about home remodeling. I mean, you think about,
yeah.
you know, even home repair products were,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I was trying
hard to
get some. Yeah, I was trying to get stuff to make some, you know, for my current institution, and
mm-hmm.
it's hard to find plywood. But
well, things weren't being shipped either. I think
yeah.
was part of it was just not
fewer
you know,
shipments.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. yeah.
Yep, yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Danny, to round up and round out our interview for today, we have a stock question for all folks at the very end. What is your advice as a senior museum professional to those just entering the field? You know, those students or, you know, those bright-eyed things that are thinking about museums, but they haven't quite made that leap yet. What's your advice to them?
My advice is to know ahead of time that you're going to have to be flexible. Very flexible. Like, you know, I imagine somebody going through a museum program in grad school or something like that and getting just super interested in this very specific thing and so much so that they're almost like a rock star expert on that one thing, and then they get the job and they realize that's one thing that I can do maybe 5 to 10 hours a week, because they're having me do these other 30 hours watching the front desk or doing something else. And so you know, that thought, that's not my job. I could never imagine how many times that's gone through my head. That's not my job. You know, but so I would tell, yeah, and yeah, now it is. So I would tell somebody like that to be flexible at the start, get in there. You don't have to stay at one place for 20 years, but if you do find that you've stayed in one place for a long time, know that becomes an asset. So because if the directors are rotating out, like I know at one point, I think around my 14th year of being in the museum, I'd had 6 bosses.
Oh, wow.
So, and one of them lasted 4 years. So I couldn't quite figure that out, but on paper, that's what it looks like. So you end up becoming the person with the institutional knowledge. So when the new boss comes in, you're going to know some things that worked and some things that didn't work just from observation. So, you know, be flexible, know that you're going to have to adapt to the situation, and then remember everything that's going on, because down the road, it's going to pay off.
That's so true. Thank you so much, Danny. We really appreciate this conversation with
Welcome.
You.
It was fun.
All right. That wraps up this episode of the M-Files. We'd like to thank Danny for joining us and for sharing his insights and experiences. Before we sign off, keep the conversation going by following us on Facebook at the M-Files Podcast. Also, we want to hear from you. Email any questions or comments to the show to the mfilespodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on Facebook. We would also appreciate your support on Patreon. Please follow the link on our Facebook page to support our podcast. Our next episode will be dropping on Friday, April 9th, and we will be talking to another one of our museum colleagues. One of our museum colleagues. One of our museum colleagues. One of our